You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. In a news conference last week, the Racine County Sheriff's Department raised suspicions about voting in nursing homes during the pandemic, but didn't recommend any criminal charges to date. The department said that some Racine residents think their loved ones who live in a nursing home didn't have the cognitive ability to vote and feel like their loved ones may have been taken advantage of. But disability rights advocates say whether a person can exercise their constitutional right is up to them and can only be restricted by a court ruling. We're taking a closer look at how voting works in nursing homes and how to make voting more accessible for people living with disabilities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how voting in nursing homes works? Are you a nursing home resident yourself, or do you have a loved one in a care facility? If so, what was the voting process like there? Or if you work in one, love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Barbara Beckert is Director of External Advocacy for Southeast Wisconsin at Disability Rights Wisconsin. She's also the director of the group's Milwaukee office. Barbara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, a big part of this story is the Special Voting Deputy Program. Can you tell us what that is and how it works?
Sure. Happy to fill you in on that. So Wisconsin has a program to allow support for voters who live in care facilities, nursing homes, or other care facilities like group homes, adult family homes, and so on. And that calls for special voting deputies to be sent to qualified facilities to administer absentee ballots for facility residents who are eligible and who are registered to vote. And there is a lot of detail that goes behind that. So, for example, for a care facility to be eligible to receive a visit from special voting deputies, they need to have at least 5 residents who are already registered to vote, 1 resident who has an absentee ballot request on file. And if they don't have those things in place, special voting deputies will not visit. That's why it's important that care facility staff have the ability to help support voters and to help support their residents with voting.
Yeah, if I live in a care facility, I could still just request an absentee ballot and mail it in just like anybody else could, right?
Yeah, well, the way that it works is that special voting deputies are required to make 2 visits to a care facility. They don't always get to see all of the residents. So if you don't vote with the special voting deputy, then your absentee ballot application and have an absentee ballot application on file, then your ballot is supposed to be sent to you after the SVDs have made the required 2 visits. So yes, you can vote in a care facility without support from a special voting deputy.
How much difficulty did the pandemic add to the situation of voting from these care facilities?
It created tremendous difficulty, and a great deal of time and deliberation was put into how to ensure that 2 things were addressed, both the voting rights of care facility residents, including nursing homes, and their health, their right to life, because these were the most vulnerable individuals. So when special voting deputies visit, they must visit twice. There are 2 of them, along with the special voting deputies, partisan observers accompany them, and family members are also allowed to observe. So that's a number of individuals. If special voting deputies had been dispatched, these individuals would have had to go into nursing homes, where the most vulnerable individuals live, the most vulnerable to COVID-19 and the highest death rate. They would have needed to go into these facilities 2 times during the pandemic and to be in pretty intimate contact with people. When you're assisting people to vote, particularly if they're individuals who may be low vision or blind or not have the ability to complete a ballot for themselves because they have limited use of their hands, you have to be in pretty close contact. So those were the decisions that our policymakers at the Wisconsin Election Commission agonized over and that we agonized over as disability advocates, because we're concerned. We want to ensure that care facility residents have the right to vote, but we also want to make sure that their health and their lives are not endangered. And ultimately, I think the consensus was that sending in special voting deputies and putting them in close proximity to these vulnerable individuals would put their lives at risk, and that that was not a safe, humane, or prudent thing to do during the pandemic.
Barbara Beckert is with us from Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're looking at access to voting for people who live in various kinds of care facilities, including nursing homes, after accusations from the Racine County Sheriff's Office that the Wisconsin Elections Commission got it wrong with how they handled voting in nursing homes, a particular nursing home in that county. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with the issue. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. I want to listen to some of the press conference from the Racine County Sheriff's Department last week. This is Sergeant Michael Lewell.
I want to be very careful here. People have a right to vote. People have varying degrees of understanding, and I get that. And people who, you know, you don't need a PhD to vote, all right? But these loved ones believe their loved ones had such cognitive difficulties that they would not have had the ability to request a ballot and exercise their right to vote.
So what role are family members allowed to play, if any, in a loved one's voting in a care facility?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, in Wisconsin, the standard for the capacity to vote is minimal, capable of understanding the objective of the elective process is a standard that is in our state constitution. There's no cognitive standard that's imposed on people not alleged to be incompetent. So people can only lose the right to vote due to allegations of incompetency that have been contested in our court system, either through guardianship or by a standalone petition. And that means that family members do not have the ability or the right to say that someone is not able to vote. And I know that's sometimes confusing. If the family member is a guardian and the person has lost their right to vote, then the family member does have a role to play. They can ensure that the facility and the person are aware of this and have a copy of the guardianship papers. If it's a family member of a person with some impairment, they may be present if the person consents when the individual votes. You should always ask the person if he or she wishes to vote privately or not. They have the same right to vote privately, just as you or I do. So it's up to the voter to decide who can assist them in voting. But many people might want a family member to assist them by being present. And just to be clear, the individual who is assisting them, whether it's a staff member, a family member, or someone else, may only assist them as the voter directs. It is illegal to coerce someone in any way about how they should vote or to complete the ballot on their behalf. And that's sometimes confusing for family members. At Disability Rights Wisconsin, we have a voter hotline, and we've been contacted before by family members who indicate, my family member who has a cognitive disability is confused about who they want to vote for. So I'm going to be completing the ballot for them with who I think they should vote for. That's against the law. That's not okay.
Well, and it sounds like some of the concern in Racine County, Barbara, is that family members might be worried that if a care facility person is helping with that vote, they're worried that maybe their loved one is being exploited here, that they think the person, their loved one, wouldn't be able to fill this out. They're worried that the care facility person is making that decision for them. How do we make sure that that kind of exploitation doesn't happen?
Well, as an advocate for people with disabilities and older adults, I'm the first one to be concerned if people are being coerced in any way and if staff members are inappropriately filling out a ballot. Their role is to complete the ballot as directed by the voter, if the voter requests assistance, and to assist them in any way that's needed. I can tell you that the Wisconsin Election Commission provided extremely detailed guidance to care facility members on the process that should be followed with voter registration, absentee voting, completing the ballot, witnessing it, and any kind of accommodations. For example, if someone does need help completing a ballot and request that, again, perhaps someone is low vision, blind, doesn't have use of their hands, they are legally entitled to get assistance completing their ballot. They may request that. And there's also a requirement that the assister sign their name on the absentee ballot, so it is documented that they have received assistance.
We're talking to Barbara Becker, Director of External Advocacy for Southeast Wisconsin at Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're talking about voting accessibility for people living in care facilities, including nursing homes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's allowed and not allowed to help nursing home residents vote? Do you work in some kind of care facility in Wisconsin? How has voting worked where you work? And if you are one of the voters we're talking about, if you live in some kind of assisted care facility, love to hear your perspective at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at voting in nursing homes and other care facilities during the pandemic. Barbara Beckert with Disability Rights Wisconsin stays with us, and you can join in with your thoughts, your questions about how this works, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to your calls now. Melanie is with us in Madison. Melanie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Melanie?
Well, I want to talk about this concept of cognitive impairment that seems to be being tossed around. It's sort of like the assumption that everyone who lives in a nursing home is cognitively impaired. I had the guardianship of my brother who lived in a nursing home with a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And when the guardianship was established, I specifically asked the judge that he continued to be able to continue to have his voting rights, which she agreed with, until near his death. Although you couldn't understand him very well in his spoken word, he couldn't walk. But until near his death, he remained very alert, very interested in the news, very interested in what was going on. So just because a person has a diagnosis like Parkinson's, MS, ALS, all of these diagnoses that are neurological diagnoses, they may affect a certain part of the brain, but not the total brain. And so the person continues to be alert, continues to be knowledgeable in reasoning and so forth and so on. So I think that before people begin to assume that everybody who lives in a nursing home is cognitively impaired and should not be able to vote, they should understand a little bit more about how the brain is and how it works. And I would also comment with regard to visual problems that people have. If the state of Wisconsin was in compliance with the ADA guidelines on having a ballot that can be completed on the computer, they would not have to give so much help to visually impaired people, because visually impaired people are very technically alert and use computers all the time. And so they could do this kind of ballot, and many states have it, but Wisconsin is not in compliance. And I would suggest that in some of the legislatures who are so busy trying to take advantage of vulnerable people spend their time ensuring that this state is in compliance with federal law.
Melanie, thanks for the call. A lot to work with there. Barbara, first of all, Melanie's first point, not to assume that everybody in a care facility is cognitively impaired to the point where they couldn't vote.
Yeah, great points by Melanie. As she said, a medical diagnosis does not disqualify a person from voting. So Parkinson's, Alzheimer's disease, traumatic brain injury, other types of cognitive impairment do not disqualify a person from being eligible to vote. And I think her points are so important, because we see often people with cognitive impairments or elderly people experience discrimination, and that they really have to aggressively assert their right to vote. And that shouldn't be the case.
And Melanie also mentioned visual impairments and accessibility. And I think that's something your organization is also looking for, Barbara.
Yes. Wisconsin is kind of an outlier in this regard. A growing number of states are providing voters with disabilities with the option of a screen reader accessible Americans with Disabilities Act compliant absentee ballot. And that allows equitable access to absentee voting for voters with blindness, vision, or other disabilities who don't have the ability to physically mark the ballot and need assistive technology. I've heard some really concerning stories from individuals who are blind and want to be as independent as possible, and they're very reluctant to have to ask someone else to fill out their absentee ballot. They don't feel confident that they know how that person is completing the ballot on their behalf. And Wisconsin needs to step up and join the growing number of other states who have become in compliant with the ADA, you know, which has been around for 31 years now, and offered the ability for an accessible absentee ballot.
Melanie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Hope in Milwaukee. Hope, hello.
Hi, thanks very much for answering my call. I agree with Melanie about not everybody with certain disabilities are incapable of making decisions. And I, as an individual, don't have the right to make that decision for anybody else. I found there's huge barriers for people in nursing homes, and it worries me greatly that we would be taking away somebody's right to vote just because they end up in a nursing home for whatever reason that is, and just because somebody has a diagnosis of a cognitive disability, or people assume, maybe by the way they're talking due to a stroke, that they're not able to make decisions. And in America, I think voting is a big one, and people should not lose their right, again, because they end up in a nursing home.
Hope, thanks a lot for the call. Barbara, are there other obstacles for people in nursing homes or other care facilities, apart from the access to special voting deputies that we've been talking about? Are there other hurdles you'd like to help take out of the way here?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, people who live in nursing homes and care facilities are often very isolated. So it's actually important that staff have the opportunity and the training, because voting can be complicated. So they should have the necessary information so that they can offer their residents the option. Are you registered to vote? Do you need to change your address because you just moved from another location to this facility? Do you want to have an absentee ballot application on file? So providing that support by care workers is critical. And without that, care facility residents will be disenfranchised. For those who live in the community, some of the barriers that we see have to do with accessibility. A number of our polling places are not accessible. The Wisconsin Election Commission does have an accessibility audit program, but with the thousands of polling places in Wisconsin, it's very small. We'd like to see our policymakers provide more funding for that program. And transportation is another significant barrier because so many people are non-drivers.
Thanks for that call, Hope. We'll go to Judy now in Milwaukee. Judy, hello.
Hi there. I appreciate this conversation. Thank you. I was a director of nursing for 20-some-odd years, and voting is a hot topic in long-term care facilities. I think one of the issues that families don't necessarily understand that an activation of a healthcare power of attorney does not eliminate an individual's rights to vote. It doesn't even eliminate their individual right to make decisions. And there is, I think, in general, a huge misunderstanding of individual rights in long-term care facilities. I apologize if I missed just now because I was talking to your intake person. But the other thing with actually going to a polling place for people who live in facilities, that was the new voter ID laws. That is really challenging. If you have someone who's lived in a facility for years, They don't have a Wisconsin ID. They don't have a driver's license. They don't have a utility bill. Proof of ID is extremely difficult and really discriminatory towards individuals who are living in facilities because they need help with their physical or sometimes cognitive care.
Thanks a lot for that call, Judy. Not a lot of time left, but Barbara, I know you are also focusing on voter ID for people in care facilities. Are there changes you'd like to see made?
Yeah, Wisconsin has the most restrictive photo ID law in the country, and this affects people in the community even more than people in care facilities. So many people with disabilities are non-drivers. While Wisconsin does have a free photo ID card for voting available from DMV locations, you need transportation to get there. And that's very problematic, especially for people who need accessible transportation or who live in rural areas. So we would like to see other options offered. For example, a number of states offer the option of an affidavit of affirmation in lieu of photo ID. It can include the elector's residential address, date of birth, and they sign a statement affirming their identity. There are a number of states like Idaho, South Carolina, South Dakota, Delaware, Connecticut, and others who offer this option. So it's time for Wisconsin to revisit our photo ID policy and the restrictions that it opposes, which disenfranchise many voters with disabilities and older adults.
Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Beckert with Disability Rights Wisconsin, looking at voting accessibility issues for people living in care facilities. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll hear the final episode of the WPR podcast Mapped Out with the aftermath of Republican-friendly election district lines and a look at the future. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at why more and more younger people are putting off marriage and some of the economic effects of that decision. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court heard from both sides yesterday in a challenge to a Texas abortion law, which is the most restrictive in the nation. An expert on abortion laws and the courts tells us what's at stake for the rest of the country. First, if you're young, single, and broke, you've got company. According to Pew Research Center, in 2019, 38% of American adults aged 25 to 34 were single, meaning neither married nor living with a partner. Again, that's 38%. That's up from 29% back in 1990. The study found other big changes in that time span. In 1990, two-thirds of adults between 25 and 54 were married. By 2019, it was down to just over half. Meanwhile, unmarried cohabitation rose from 4 to 9%. And the data shows that single people are worse off economically than those who are married and those who are living together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to know your story, especially if you're in those younger age ranges. Let us know if you're married, single, or living with a partner and what led to that decision. If you're not married, do you want to be someday, or are you pretty happy with that current arrangement? How's that different from what your parents are doing? And if you're watching younger generations, maybe in your own family, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephanie Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families at the University of Texas at Austin. She's also an Emeritus Faculty of History and Family Studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and author of a bunch of books on gender, family, and history, including Marriage, A History, How Love Conquered Marriage. Stephanie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, first of all, let's start with the number of people married. No surprise to you. I think we've talked about this before, younger people getting less likely to be married over the years. Can you talk about that trend?
Well, absolutely. I think there's a lot of unnecessary panic and dramatization of this. Mm-hmm. Back in the 1960s, when 90% of Americans did marry, the highest proportion ever, half of all women married before they even turned 21. The age of marriage has been steadily rising, and that means if you take the proportion of people aged 25 to 40 who aren't married, it's going to sound like, oh my gosh, it's really been falling since the 1960s. But actually, as of 2014, 80% of Americans had been married by the time they were in their 40s. Now, that's a lot later than in earlier years, but it means that marriage is not necessarily dying. We're just spending a lot more time outside marriage, and people are putting off marriage much longer than they used to.
And what's behind that story, which is really behind the story of those numbers I gave? What is leading us to get married later than, say, a couple few generations ago?
Well, I think there are a couple things that help explain the increased delay. I mean, first of all, let's start by going back to the 50s or 60s when everybody got married so early. There were a couple things that explained that. It was one of them I think people might think was a pretty good idea, and that is that in the 50s and 60s, there were rising real wages for young men. A young man could take almost any job and expect his earnings to improve substantially over time, to have job security. So it was obviously a little more optimistic about starting a family. The other side of the reason that more people got married then was that it was the opposite way for women. The only way they could participate in the economic prosperity in a time when help-wanted female was at much lower wages. A woman with a college degree earned less than a man with a high school degree if she was able to find a full-time job. So they had no, they had to get married. And since then, we've seen a number of changes. First of all, women have gained more options. They can put off marriage. They can have education. And incidentally, the longer a woman puts off marriage and the more education she gets, the less likely it is to divorce once she does get married. But the other side of the coin is that men, the real wages for men, for many men, the high school graduate, for example, back in the 50s and 60s, who could expect his wages to rise steadily, his wages have been falling. So marriage is a more kind of problematic risk than it used to be for both men and for women, even though there are some high payoffs to getting married if you find the right partner.
Talking to Stephanie Kuntz with the Council on Contemporary Families, author of books including A Marriage, A History, talking about changes in whether and, more importantly, maybe when we get married. Younger people less likely to be married than we used to. We tend to get married later in life than we used to. You can join in 800-642-1234. I'd love to hear your story of deciding when and whether to get married, whether you have yet or are planning to do it someday or aren't planning on it at all, and what drives that decision for you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Stephanie, that Pew study I mentioned earlier, one thing that puzzled me a little bit, they seem to be saying that married people got an economic benefit from marriage. Unmarried people, single people in these age groups, not doing as well. And that made me wonder, okay, is there something about being married that makes you make more money? Or is there something about having more money that makes you more likely to get married in the first place?
Well, most of it goes the opposite way. You know, there are some ways in which singles are punished by the society that doesn't recognize that many of them also have obligations, caregiving obligations and stuff. But most single people are not poorer because they aren't married. More often, they haven't married because they don't earn enough to feel secure about getting married or don't have a pool of potential partners. That's another way in which we're different from the 50s and 60s. It takes two incomes to make a family work today. And so it's not just women who are looking for a man who has decent earnings and prospects, and you can count on to maybe stay the course with you that you got a pretty good chance with. It's women, men are looking for the same thing in women. So the result is that people are putting off marriage until the lucky ones are putting it off until they get their education. And educated men and women are actually the most likely to marry now, and educated women are much more likely than they were in the past. They're also much less likely to divorce. Whereas on the other hand, people who have less than a college education, their real wages have been falling, job insecurity has been rising, income volatility has been increasing. And so it's a really hard trade-off. On the one hand, yes, if you meet somebody who you think can hold down a job, will hold down a job, will be reliable, then there are economic advantages to marrying. You can pool your resources, you know, you can you know, specialize more in different kinds of things. You can save money. You can both earn more money. But on the other hand, it's a bigger risk than it used to be because divorce is more easy, job loss is more easy. So women in particular are beginning to think, you know, okay, here's the risk. Should I invest in my own earnings power, stay single, wait until I'm really sure that I can afford to buy into a marriage and won't be ruined if, you know, and I think of it sometimes like playing poker, that if you have enough of a financial commission to make the, you know, a cushion to make the minimum opening bid, and, you know, if you lose a hand, you know that you can still support yourself, it's a really good deal. Bet the whole pot emotionally and materially. But if you don't, it's kind of risky.
You know, we might think love conquers all. Do you think we have this element rational, or, you know, overtly or maybe deep down, this level of, I guess, calculation in our marriage prospects still?
Oh, I think we always have. Actually, in some ways, it's much less so than in the past when a woman really had to say, and I've read letters and diaries of women who said, well, you know, my heart really inclines to Mike, but John looks like he's the only one who'd be able to support me. Now you've got more ability to marry for love. But at the same time, we have these high expectations of marriage, and we have high expectations of what we want out of life. And so people tend to think, well, I want a partner who can pull his or her fair share of the load, both emotionally and materially.
We're looking at marriage trends in the United States as younger people are delaying marriage in many cases, on average, in a lot of cases. Stephanie Kuntz is with us, Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're in that younger age group, what are your thoughts on marriage right now? Are you already married? Are you thinking yes, but not for a while? What goes into that kind of decision if you're thinking carefully about it? If you are older, what was your trajectory? Married right out of high school, right out of college, or did you put it off? Why? What led to that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. We've heard the big picture data. Want to hear your examples, your life story, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And what's money got to do with it? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about the growing number of younger people who are choosing to remain single, at least for now. New analysis from Pew Research Center found that 38% of American adults from 25 to 34 were neither married nor living with a partner, up from 29% in 1990. Stephanie Kuntz is helping us understand why that is, why we're delaying marriage more than we used to. She's the Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families at the University of Texas in Austin, Emeritus Faculty at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know if you've delayed marriage. Is it really a delay if you weren't planning on getting married earlier? If you've decided to get married later in life than previous generations did, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your story, 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Janine starts us off in Bayfield. Hi, Janine.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
So I just wanted to bring up with getting married, kind of talking about the benefits, not so much financially. When getting married, your health care, all of that changes, your taxes, those change as well. And I noticed that I lost my health care due to that because it went up about 500% the price. So kind of looking how to gauge that.
So those costs you're saying went up when you got married, your health care and your taxes?
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Thanks, Janine. And Stephanie, that's part of the calculation. I think some people may make the decision to push it over the edge and get married to get access to health care, but those costs factor in.
Well, the tax one is a very interesting, ironic thing, because the tax law was changed in the 1940s to encourage male breadwinner families so that it penalized you if you had a second earner in the house. So actually, people who try to reproduce an Ozzie and Harriet family, they get a big tax advantage when they're married. But in today's world where actually both partners do tend to work, there are some real tax disadvantages, and supposedly the whole thing was supposed to increase marriage rates and, you know, create this Ozzie and Harriet family that people were so interested in having in the post-war era.
Janine, thanks for that call. That reminds me, you've done some research. This is separate from the Pew stuff I was talking about, Stephanie, saying in a growing number of households, Harriet may be providing more of the breadwinning than Ozzie. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, actually, this is a new, just out today, there's a new study from Jennifer Glass and Joanna Pepin and Kelly Rayleigh are the ones who did the actual research. Mm-hmm. And they found out that it used to be that married women were seldom the main providers, but about 40% of married women today are the primary earner in their family, which means that you've got a situation where they estimate from their studies that 70% of American women will be the primary provider for their child at some point before the child turns 18. And, you know, that's maybe it won't last for very long, but the average length of time a woman does this is 6 years. So that's another very important reason to think about, you know, who you're marrying, what you're marrying, what you bring to the marriage. And, of course, with the problems with the pandemic, the job losses and cutbacks for women, the lack of good comprehensive child care, it's not just women who are being hurt by this. Children's well-being is being seriously affected if the main provider in a family, as women now often are, is unable to hold down that job.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Kim in Iowa. Kim, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Kim?
Well, I find this topic very fascinating. My husband and I, our marriage is kind of a combination of reasons for late marriage. We had our first marriages, we're only marriage. I was 38, he was 42. We're in our 50s now. And he delayed marriage because he grew up in a family situation where there was a lot of discord over finances, and so he wanted to be secure in his career. I, on the other hand, my mom died when I was 17, and I had a 1.5 and a 13-year-old sister. So I did child rearing from 17 to 23 until my dad remarried, and by the time he remarried, I was not interested in starting a family at all. I was done. So... but then by the time I was in my mid to late 30s, I wanted children. So that was our reasons for delay. I think maybe different than some. Mine was different than most people's. But
interesting. Kim, thank you so much for sharing your story. I hope that the first marriage can stay your only marriage. Best of luck to both of you. Stephanie, yeah, there are a lot of different paths, but a lot of them seem to take us to the same place, getting married later.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this is the most interesting thing, is that really there's such a variety nowadays that there's no longer any single type of marriage, and there's no longer any single route to marriage. And in fact, one of the things that's changing now is we're becoming a little bit more like the European countries, where some couples, especially educated couples, may wait until they have a baby and then get married after that. So there's a lot of changes that are going on, but one of the things that people tend to forget is that when people do enter marriage today, divorce rates have been falling for the last 20 years, precisely because there's a greater selection in terms of who marries, and that we wait longer for it, and we tend to be more sure of ourselves, both economically and emotionally.
Thanks a lot for that call and for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Suzelle in Janesville. Suzelle, hi.
Hi. I was just curious whether the research that you're talking about applies only to opposite-sex couples, or is it also based on same-sex couples?
We haven't had legal same-sex marriage enough to have really good long-term results in terms of divorce rates. But we know that same-sex couples have some tremendous advantages, incidentally, over heterosexual couples. Right now, one of the best predictors of marital satisfaction for a heterosexual couple is how, especially for the woman in it, is how fair the division of housework and childcare is. And one problem that heterosexual couples have is they often just fall into the pattern of reproducing, okay, women do this, men do this, whereas same-sex couples tend to discuss those things a lot more. We found that in general, that, you know, and I don't want to, again, this material is just coming in, but there is a sense that probably the most stable marriage is the least likely to divorce, and again, possibly because of selection factors, are two males. Female couples tend to have, in many instances, have very satisfying relationships, female-female ones. They understand each other better. They're more on the same page about their emotional conversations. But they also have much higher expectations of intimacy, and sometimes that becomes a problem in a female-female marriage. But one of the things that I think is so exciting about all this diversity we've been talking about is we now can look at what other people are doing and realize we don't have to follow a script. There's all these choices, and we can learn from things that other people are doing. We can pick and choose.
Suzelle, thanks a lot for the call. And Stephanie, I think we've talked about this, the division of labor at home, and it sounds like a takeaway there for anyone in any kind of marriage is talk about it, consciously decide this stuff up instead of just sort of letting things fall where they may.
Exactly, exactly. Talking it over is the big predictor. It's not how, it's not what decisions you end up making, it's how you get there.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Stephanie Kuntz is with us from Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, looking at some of the latest research on marriage in the United States, people more likely to put off marriage to later years than they used to. Stephanie, I should throw another family member in here. Kids, what's happening when it comes to the timing of couples having, or single people for that matter, having children?
Well, one of the things, people, their fertility rates have been falling for some time, and of course they fell even more during the pandemic. So we're going to have to see what happens as we come out of that. But one of the things that is quite interesting is that although sole parenting has fallen, actually, unmarried parenting has increased, that many cohabiting couples go ahead and have kids and rather than getting married. And then there are other plenty of people, as I said, like more, not as many in the United States as in Scandinavia, who actually have very stable cohabiting relationships, and even if they have one or two kids without marriage, they often tend to eventually get married. So there's a lot of changes in childbearing, and I think they're connected to a bunch of these same economic and social pressures that we've been talking about.
In our last minute, Stephanie, I know the pandemic has shaken up a lot of people's thoughts about work, a lot of people leaving jobs. I'm sure the data isn't there for marriages and such yet. But what's one of the big questions in your mind for how the pandemic might affect our attitude toward our relationships?
Well, I think that some couples have found that, and some families have found that, gosh, you know, chasing after extracurricular activities was actually too exhausting, and we need to slow down. Others have found that it's just been too much. One interesting thing is that men did step up to the plate in terms of housework and childcare during the pandemic. But the one really bad sticking point was that when it came to something new, like taking over homeschooling, I think the default, without discussing it, was, okay, well, only women can do that, you know? And so that was just a tremendous stress on marriages and on relationships. And we're just going to have to see if people learn the right lessons from this, or if, in fact, the conflicts that rose and the tensions are going to outweigh the useful lessons that have been used by some couples, that have been taken by some couples during this pandemic.
Stephanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Stephanie Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education for the Council on Contemporary Families at the University of Texas at Austin. We talked to her about why more and more young people are delaying marriage and some of the economic effects of that decision. Coming up after the news, one of the nation's top experts on the legal history of abortion explains what's happening with Texas and Mississippi abortion laws at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network